first subject we want to look at this evening, the whole question of the origin of life. And I suppose before we discuss the origin of life, we need to construct some kind of definition on what life is. I'm not sure anybody knows exactly what life is, but I suggest here a minimal definition, a self-reproducing material system, a machine, we might call it, though a machine we tend to think very mechanically, which can make a copy of itself, would be sort of a minimal definition of life. Now, from a Christian perspective, it may well be that life is more complicated than that, that just a self-reproducing machine won't do everything that life does, but it need not be more complicated than that from a Christian perspective. Biblical material tells us that God made life, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it would not be possible for mankind to make life eventually as well. So we're going to operate in terms of this minimal definition, a self-reproducing material system, as a definition for the origin of life. I'd like to look a little bit here at some of the alternative proposals that have been made for the origin of life. And the first proposal doesn't technically fit this particular question, because the first proposal is life doesn't have an origin. Life has always existed. And if we define life rather more broadly than a self-reproducing material system, we define life to include God, because God speaks of himself as the living God, as opposed to the gods that men have constructed in our own minds by extrapolation, and then it's probably fair to say that there's some sense in which number one is correct. Life has always existed. However, here we're thinking of the more minimal definition, self-reproducing material system, and in this sense, then the biggest problem with the idea that life has always existed is the rather substantial evidence that we have that this universe was once in a situation that would be very hard to imagine life existing in. We extrapolate backwards into time, the universe we've got now, the temperature of the universe goes up. The temperature of the universe right now is only about 3 degrees above absolute zero on the average. But back a few 100,000 years after the Big Bang, the temperature was about 3,000 degrees. And already that would be problematical to imagine any kind of life as we know it existing. And if cosmologists are correct that the universe began at the Big Bang at either an infinite temperature and density, or at least a temperature and density far higher than that of the interior of the sun, far higher than several million degrees, and far higher than the density of water, perhaps the density a million or a billion times that much, then it's hard to imagine any kind of life that we can know of that would have existed under those circumstances. Going back, as cosmologists believe we can, into history, we would reach a temperature of about 3,000 degrees in which the universe would become opaque. Right now, the universe is basically clear. And going back before that, you eventually get to a point where matter and antimatter are almost equal in numbers, and they're annihilating each other, enormous energies involved. And going back before that, you even get back to the subparticles beneath matter that we call quarks and such. And it's hard to imagine anything existing in that that would have somehow come through it and continue to be functioning as life as well. Now, of course, if you imagine that life could somehow come in from outside what we call the universe and such, then you can imagine life has always existed. That idea is around, but has these rather serious mechanical problems to it. The second suggestion here, life arose by supernatural intervention, etc., is the one I would suggest that we really have the best evidence for, and we'll be looking at some of that in our talk this evening and in some of the other talks as well. I use intervention here fairly broadly at this point to mean this. Life was designed by a designer, okay? And he may have worked either miraculously to put life into the universe, or he might have worked providentially to put life into the universe. He might have guided certain molecules to come together in such a way that they would then make copies of themselves. I think there's more to it than that, but that would be kind of a minimal form of theistic evolution. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a later talk. So that would all fall under this category, life arose by supernatural intervention. That there is a designer, there's a mind behind the universe, and this mind, this designer, has impressed his design into the universe to make life. And he's done that either miraculously or in some, what we would call in theology, providential means, guiding natural processes to do that particular sort of thing. The view that is most widely espoused in our media and in most scientific circles, is the third of these, that life arose by purely natural means. Persons from this position typically, though not always, hold a worldview that there is no God, that the universe is finally self-explanatory in some sense, and that as a result of that, one must explain the origin of life. Life must have had an origin because of this problem of the high temperatures and densities early in the universe, and since there isn't any supernatural, that life must have arisen by natural processes. Various suggestions have been made. Some have suggested life will occur naturally anytime the physical conditions are right, and something arises rather easily. Or others have said life may be something that arises very, very rarely. One writer I read recently, Richard Dawkins, in his book The Blind Watchmaker, suggests that he would feel justified in his model, a naturalistic origin of life, if there was one chance in 10 to the 20th that life would arise on a given planet with proper physical conditions in a course of a billion years. That's a rather low level. What he's suggesting is, he's really suggesting this, there's life on Earth. Well, grant that. That the life on Earth apparently arose in the first billion years of its history. We're not here ready to get into questioning the age of the Earth, Terry Phillips will be looking at that later, but grant that, okay? And then the point is, there he estimates there are perhaps 10 to the 20th Earth-like planets in the universe, okay? And it's hard to judge the answer to that because we have not yet got devices. Sure, there are any other planets in the universe than most people work in the field. Few of the planets themselves are fairly common. And Earth-like planets depends on how much definition you've got to give to Earth-like planets. But if there are 10 to the 11th, 10 to the 12th stars in our galaxy, Milky Way, and even one of those an Earth-like planet, you'd already have 10 to the 11th in our galaxy. And then if there are 10 to the 11th galaxies, which we think there's someone for, then it might not be too hard to get 10 to the 20th planets in the universe. Or if you imagine there's only one planet, Earth-like planet per 100 suns, still at 10 to the 11th, that is 100 billion galaxies in the universe and 100 billion stars in a medium, a slightly large galaxy, you could still make the things work out right. We're going to suggest down here a bit that that number, one chance in 10 to the 20 per Earth-like planet per billion years, is probably too high. And therefore, even with that rather generous assumption that there may be some real trouble for a naturalistic origin of life. I'd like to look with you then first at some of the major scenarios for a naturalistic origin of life. I'm really going to sketch one primary one and one modification to it that has been proposed to get over a rather certain problem in the particular one. The first one, so-called organic soup model, is a common version for the origin of life that is being examined these days. I have on my overhead a three-step suggestion here, and I've broken those three steps down into, looks like, seven of them here on our on the handout notes you've got there. This is often called the organic soup model. If you all like to move down here, you can see it have a little better angle. In the organic soup model, we basically start out with simple inorganic chemicals, try and find some process that will produce from them simple organic chemicals, simple organic compounds, some way to put the organic compounds into very elaborate organic compounds we call biopolymers, and then to get the right subset of biopolymers together to form living cells. Let's take a look at the first step here, the formation of organic compounds, simple organic compounds from simple inorganic chemicals. In this model, rather heavy dependence is had upon the idea that the Earth's atmosphere early in its history was very, very different than the atmosphere we have today. The atmosphere we have today is called an oxidizing atmosphere. Presence of free oxygen in the atmosphere has a tendency to turn many, many chemicals into oxides rather rapidly or slowly, depending on temperature and depending on the nature of the chemicals themselves. It's assumed, and was frequently suggested in models for the origin of the solar system, the origin of the planet Earth, that the early atmosphere of the Earth was a reducing atmosphere, an atmosphere that tends to convert oxides to non-oxides, an atmosphere that will operate in the opposite direction of a oxidizing atmosphere. No free oxygen, and rather gases which have a tendency to remove oxygen from the atmosphere, or rather neutral in those regards. Various suggestions have been made what might have been in that atmosphere, but a common suggestion is there was water in the atmosphere, there was carbon dioxide, there was ammonia in H3, there was methane, CH4, perhaps there was free hydrogen, which would certainly help a good deal in a reducing atmosphere. That pretty well covers the sort of things that have been suggested, some combination of those. Back in the 50s, Carol Urey and his graduate student Stanley Miller did an experiment in which they took a mixture of such gases and, using a chemical pathway, I guess, passed these materials through an energy source, a spark in their case, that broke these simple molecules into rather strongly reactive pieces, that is, ions and free electrons and such, and then ran that material by a cooling device, and in the cooling device you not only get back ammonia, water, carbon dioxide, methane, you also get back some more complicated compounds. We have over here a very simple, I think it's the simplest of the amino acids. You notice it's got the same elements in it, nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, etc., but rearranged in a little more complicated way. The sugars would be similar without the nitrogens, and the nucleotide bases that are used in DNA, RNA, etc., would be rather similar as well. I believe they have phosphorus as well. You need to figure out some way to work that in from the atmosphere as well. So that would be the idea. The material is then trapped, pumped around past the spark, but trapped in a water trap after it comes through that, and that keeps the more complicated molecules from passing back around past the spark again. They do that, they just recycle back into simpler things. But with a water trap, you can build up a fair amount of such materials in the middle of your experiment. The experiment was hailed very strongly because a couple of the amino acids were formed, along with a lot of rather useless hydrocarbons and carbohydrates and other sort of products as well. So the theory was, in the early Earth, you had an atmosphere something like Miller and Urey had put in their system. You had an energy source something like their spark. Obviously, the natural thing is nearest to their spark would be lightning, and we don't know too much about meteorology of reducing atmosphere, but meteorology of our atmosphere would have lightning, and probably you would get the same sort of thing in another such atmosphere. You'd have the primeval oceans of some sort would function as a water trap, and that would be the way you'd function. To get something that's perhaps a little more pervasive as an energy source than the spark gap, our suggestion was made to use ultraviolet light coming in from the sun. That ultraviolet is basically blocked out today by ozone high in our atmosphere, but that ozone would not have been there if there were not free oxygen down below. And so if you assume reducing atmosphere with no free oxygen, you've got no ozone in the top, the ultraviolet comes down and it can do this thing. Alternatively, one might suggest using a lava of some sort, very localized, of course, near the surface of the lava, you might have enough energy also to break up these sort of things. So that would be the idea, breaking up the atmospheric molecules into reactive ions, and those then, some of them coming back to form larger molecules. Some of these molecules making it down to the water where they're safe. Water, you're not going to have trouble with the lightning. You're not going to have trouble with the ultraviolet, certainly. And you won't have much trouble with the lava, although localized places underwater you might get quite a hot lava. That's the idea. So production of organic molecules, rather simple organic molecules, sugars, amino acids, etc., formed by reducing atmosphere with the right energy source and some way of shielding the material from that. The theory then is that you build up an organic soup, that the ocean becomes a thicker and thicker soup, usually done with some kind of a pond, since there are problems that you would see with the amount of organic soup you're going to get in the ocean. So the organic molecules dissolve in water, form this organic soup. And then the organic soup is concentrated some way, perhaps in a pond by evaporation, but that's got some problems if it's solar evaporation. As soon as the water evaporates, you're back in the sunlight again. If you've got ultraviolet, you tear the stuff down again. So usually something rather elaborate is thought of in terms of water washing into a little pond inside a cave, and sufficient heat to evaporate the thing down. That may recall volcanic heat of some sort, because it's hard to get a lot of sunlight heat inside a cave, and you're not going to get much lightning, and you're not going to get much else to heat things up in a cave. So you get a nice small pond inside a cave, and you're out of the ultraviolet, you're out of the lightning. Maybe you've got lava near enough to warm the cave up to evaporate the stuff, and the idea is that you'd be able to get some, in a low water situation, you might be able to get some polymerization to form the macromolecules. Then it's postulated that somewhere in the formation of these macromolecules, something almost magical happens. You get a self-reproducing macromolecule, a molecule that can make a copy of itself. Or, what more complicatedly, you get a set of three or four molecules that somehow between them can make copies of themselves. So that's perhaps even a more complicated system, but that's the idea. And you really need to get that step for the origin of life to work, because mutation and natural selection don't work until everybody agrees to that, until you've got reproduction of some kind. May not have to be perfect reproduction, but it's got to be pretty good reproduction in order to get a situation where you can make copies of the thing. Cells are then assumed to be a later development of some sort, because cells are not self-reproducing single molecules. It's a very complicated system of molecules that make copies of themselves. You've got the information molecule, the DNA or RNA, the DNA, excuse me, for the actual stored information. In living things, a very complicated spiral that stores information rather like a magnetic tape does, although it stores it in a molecular way rather than a magnetic way. That tape can be read by a messenger type of molecule called RNA, which makes a copy of it essentially. That is carried off to a location where that is translated into information to build some of the other molecules in the system. And in fact, in a functioning cell, you're talking about hundreds, sometimes thousands, of various proteins that are all made with this information. And the proteins can't make copies of themselves. The DNA that stores the energy, it makes copies of itself with some help from the proteins and with some help in making copies. Excuse me, it uses the proteins to make copies of itself, and then it makes copies of proteins and stuff by being translated by the cell system. So you've got a rather complicated interacting system of several thousand molecules, many of which are in the order of thousands or more atoms per molecule. That's what a living cell is. It's also characterized by several subparts in it, a membrane that allows certain materials in and out, an energy system inside that extracts energy in a nice, careful flow way from the food that the cell uses, and these ribosomes that where the molecules are constructed. So that's the organic soup organic soup model. And it has got some rather serious problems, which we're going to come look at here in a moment. But I mention only one serious problem here, and that is to introduce this other alternative, the sort of clay model, we might call it, or the clay as matrix model here. The clay as matrix model really starts out the first step the same way. Simple inorganic compounds combined to form simple organic compounds. The second step is the same. Simple organic compounds combined to form biopolymers, but to raise the probability that you will get long biopolymers in this system. The idea is that the minerals, which we call clays, are used to form a template to hold down various molecules on their surface, and then you switch from a three-dimensional problem to a two-dimensional problem to build up a rather elaborate array molecule on the surface of the clay. And so that's the primary purpose of the clay here, is to get around the problem that we'll see of a weak organic soup and to build up rather substantial macromolecules. It may also function as protection to a certain extent, because in this model perhaps you could form macromolecules underwater, which would be a very difficult thing to do in the organic soup model because of the fact that water itself is a rather strong solvent. Otherwise, the steps are rather similar. You have to get reproducing macromolecules somewhere along the line, or a system that functions as reproducing macromolecules. Then one additional problem, however, of bringing the clay in the first place is you've got to get the clay out at the other end. You've got to phase the clay out of the system in some way. and then still wind up with the rather complicated system we've got, the cells at the other end. The complexity we're working with here is rather substantial. Carl Sagan, who's written this article on lice in the last couple editions of Encyclopedia Britannica, tries to describe the complexity of the simplest living cell with a computer analogy. He says the information content of the simplest cells is around the equivalent of 10 to the 12th power bits of information. A bit, for those who are in computer stuff, is straightforward. For those who aren't, it's a binary digit. It's a digit that's either 1 or 0, and you need 10 to the 12th power of those to code the information of a living cell. To convert that into more reasonably understandable terms, Sagan chose to say that's equivalent to 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which if you then convert down to sets at 1,000 pages a volume and 25 volumes a set, which was the 1970 edition anyway, I think the Macropedia, Micropedia was a couple more volumes than that, you wind up with about 4,000 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. That's the information stored in simplest living cells. Naturally, a person holding to a naturalistic origin of life are inclined to think that there was some simpler thing, defining life minimally as a self-reproducing material system, that there were some kind of self-reproducing molecules that are much simpler than an existing cell, but you've still got to get up to the cell somehow, and you've got to figure out ways in which that amount of information will come in, and at least up to the reproducing macromolecule, you don't have any natural selection that's going to do anything. You don't have any reproducing population. I suggest the problem here for these models in the next heading. Here, I've already run into a few of them already with you, but let's run back through them here rather quickly. The first problem that has surfaced in the last 10 years is that investigation of the early atmosphere, done indirectly, obviously, by looking at the chemistry of the rocks that were laid down early in Earth's history, suggests that we did not have a totally reducing atmosphere early in Earth's history, but that, in fact, there was a moderate amount of oxygen present as far back as we can investigate anything of that sort. That's a rather serious problem, because a moderate amount of oxygen is going to cause a serious trouble for getting the right kind of chemical reactions to go. So presumably, if one is going to admit that you have a amount even like 15-20% 2-3% oxygen, only 20% now, about a tenth of what we've got now, you're going to run into some problems with the reactions to go, and the solution would have to try to get somewhere where there's not oxygen. Maybe with clays under enough water, you could get out of the oxygen in some way, but some kind of problem has got to go that way. Another problem is the problem that at least in the open ocean, you're going to get extremely weak soup. So you've got to imagine some very strong way of concentrating this material. Well, you of course can work with a little pond, and the pond is evaporated down. Then you've got to work, however, with the problem that they're not going to be the only chemicals there. There are a number of other chemicals there. Certainly, the modern seawater, you know, great many salts there when you evaporate things down rather heavily like that. But that's really about the only way you can get around the water opposing the polymerization without bringing in the clays to try and help you out in that direction. A problem both of these face, which I just mentioned here in the one phrase, is competing reactions. One of the characteristics of work that has been done in trying to synthesize larger molecules from amino acids and such is you work with very pure substances, and so you really only have one or two reaction pathways that are open. So naturally, they're the ones followed. But if in fact you've got lots of other chemicals around, which is a natural thing to expect in any kind of real chemical environment, any kind of real natural environment as opposed to a laboratory environment, you're going to get all kinds of other competing reactions going. And it's very hard to imagine any natural chemical system in which the natural thing to do is build up big macromolecules against lots of much more stable, smaller molecules that are going to be competing all up the line. So that's going to be a problem in itself. A problem I mentioned here under both of these as well is a whole question of the handedness of life molecules. the amino acids that the proteins that we see in living cells are characteristically left-handed molecules. The sugars are characteristically right-handed sugars, although in nature you would get an equal number of left- and right-handed sugars. That is the same chemical composition, but one of them is a mirror image of the other, one where certain of the side chains structure located. How is it that you wound up with living things having only the one handedness and not a mixture or not the other? Basically, I suppose one could argue, well, only one kind of handedness works well together. I have not seen that yet, seen that really shown to be the case. Even there, then one would have to say, well, okay, if that's the case, then life got its start one time only, and that quickly ate up everything else, and so nothing else really survived. That's certainly a possibility. What is the problem? Notice under the clay situation, you have basically the same kind of problem as well. There's not been as much research here. Clay chemistry is really rather complicated business, but you're still going to have the problem of competing reactions. You're still going to have the problem of the handedness of light molecules, and you've got on top of this the problem of disposal of clay. One has to postulate here that early in living things, clay formed a rather significant place, but somehow it was gotten rid of. A problem, it seems to me, that shows up several times in the question of the origin of life, and that is changing forces in the middle of stream sort of situation. For instance, in living things today, when the messenger RNA converts information on the on the RNA, or what was originally on the DNA, into making proteins, it takes three units of information off the DNA and RNA and converts it into one particular amino acid. And that's rather complicated, and so it's been postulated that maybe there was a coding system in which only two were used, the two, but then you've got to find out how to change code in the middle of the whole process. Really sort of the idea of changing the language and yet somehow having both the sender and recipient know that you've changed language, you know what it means. I think you run into some rather serious problems in that area. Lastly, on both of these, I think there is a very basic problem we're going to be seeing again and again in the whole area of origins and the whole area of explaining life, explaining the universe, etc., without recourse to a designer. And that's the question, can randomness produce organization? And how much organization can be produced by randomness in any given period of time. And so that's what I really want to try and address in the last few minutes we've got here today, this hour, excuse me, the question of randomness producing order. A remark that has been made rather commonly in this whole area is the question of, well, if you have enough time, you will get any level of order you need. And sometimes it's taken this form, give us a few monkeys enough time, and they will eventually type out an encyclopedia. And the question I think we need to ask on that is, how many monkeys, how much time, can we make any kind of calculation of that perspective, of that particular sort? The answer is yes, we can. Suppose we imagine monkeys who are trained to type on a typewriter, but not trained what to type, and they're given monkey-proof typewriters. They're trained to type at 3 characters a second, and we'll imagine them to be given special typewriters in which there are no upper and lower cases. It's all uppercase. And we'll have the 26 letters of the alphabet, and let's say, I don't know why I chose this number, but let's say another six punctuation marks and a space, so 33 keys. But I suggested that you change it slightly. It's not going to make any drastic difference in the matter. Suppose we have them type not the Encyclopedia Britannica, but the title, Encyclopedia Britannica, okay? What kind of work are we talking about? Well, it's not hard to show that for each place you're going to type, we're talking a 24-character thing here. We're ignoring the quotation marks, so you've got just count them across there with the space. You're counting 24 spaces. What you're doing is you're typing a 24-key sequence. And for each key, there are 33 different possibilities. You're asking, how many combinations are there? There are 33 raised to the 24th power. And that, converted back into our kind of normal numbers, is 3 times 10 to the 36th combinations. That's how many different things monkeys could type them if they struck 24 keys in succession. So that you've got your typewriter designed that they strike 24 keys and then it moves the paper up one line. Freezes the keys for a moment, moves the paper up one line, brings back to the carriage return, and then we'll start putting in whatever else they start typing in the set. How long does it take monkeys typing 3 characters per second to type 3 times 10 to the 36th combinations? Well, I give it here in the job terminology, you know, like man hours to paint a wall. This is monkey years. It would take 3 × 10^28 monkey years to type that particular word to guarantee. Now, we won't even guarantee to type this many combinations, okay? And then the chances are, I'm not a probabilist, there are a couple guys out here, so I'm just working on kind of shooting from the hip, is that if you type that many combinations, the chances are pretty good this one's in it, okay? So that's certainly an objectionable, I think. So that's what I'm really doing here. 3 × 10^28 monkey years. If we take the years out by saying, well, we've got 20 billion years since the origin universe, that's true in fact too, I think, then you need 1.5 billion billion monkeys. Interesting response to this I ran into in the Richard Dawkins, the blind watchmaker, recently. He said, I can show you a way to get the monkeys to type this in about 15 minutes. How's that? Well, instead of electronic typewriters, electric typewriters, you have monkeys with computer terminals, okay? And they type 28 characters, okay? So you have, let's say you have 10 monkeys. Each seated at a table with a computer terminal, and each of them types 28 characters, and then the program turns them off for a moment, and you just don't pay attention to whatever you're doing on the keyboard, and it takes in these 10 combinations. Now the trick. The computer has a program in which it tests the 10 combinations to see which one is closest to Encyclopedia Britannica. How does it do that? Well, it can subtract the one from the other, treating them as strings, and there's a way it has a numerical value for each of the numbers, each of the positions, etc. And it'll give you the one that's closest. It might only have one letter the same. Might not even have one letter the same. They might all the letters be different, but this set has each of the letters slightly closer to the goal letters than the other one does. Now, it throws that one back to all 10 monkeys and lets them type two keys, and then it freezes up on them again. The first key tells where in the chain of 24 it's going to make a change, and the second key tells what it's going to change to. And now it feeds back 10 of them to the central processor, and it checks which one of those is closest to Encyclopedia Britannica, and then it feeds that back to the 10 monkeys, and they each type two keys again, etc. And in about 15 minutes, such a program will, in fact, crank out Encyclopedia Britannica. What's going on, though? One, there's reproduction, okay? By taking this thing and putting it in and then sending it back out and having it modified, you have reproduction, okay? You're making 10 copies, so to speak, and you're putting them out for mutation, and each monkey is mutating one different letter to a different value. That's one thing you got. And yet, until you get to self-reproducing molecules, you don't have reproduction, okay? The second thing you've got is you've got a goal, and somebody to check how close you are to the goal. Dawkins himself admits that is much, much stronger than natural selection. That's a very much a goal-directed evolution, and there you get a designer, I guess, out there who is guiding things, you see? So although that's his answer to this sort of thing, he uses, methinks it is it like a weasel or something, as a quotation of a Hamlet, instead of Encyclopedia Britannica. It's the same sort of thing. He has not gotten around the problem. He's had to bring in reproduction, and he has had to bring in a goal-oriented feature. I think one of the serious problems we've got so far from an evolutionary perspective is evolutionists haven't figured out how to model on a computer what corresponds to natural selection. Interesting. Somebody think about how that might be modeled on a computer and see whether it works or not. My second sample here of a problem for of randomness producing order is the question of forming a particular 100-link amino acid chain. It's been pointed out that among the kind of proteins that exist in life, the simplest ones run about 100 amino acids in a chain, okay? So that thinking in terms of monkeys for a moment, not monkey proteins, but thinking in terms of monkey typing Encyclopedia Britannica model, we're saying the simplest kind of protein that exists in life is a 100-letter word, each letter representing an amino acid, and since there are 20 amino acids that actually operate in living things, you've got a 20-letter typewriter or a 20-letter alphabet, okay? Now, of course, molecular behavior is much faster than monkeys typing. I mean, monkeys are using molecular behavior, but not worried about that. Much faster than that. So suppose we want to try and construct the one particular simplest protein that exists in living things with 20 different amino acids. There are 20 to the 100 power possible 100-link chains, okay? You have 100 lengths, and each length one chance in 20, or one, excuse me, not one chance in 20, 20 different alternatives in each one, and we're working in terms of only one of them being right, this particular simplest one. That's not super crucial, but we'll come up here in our discussion. 20 to 100 converted into powers of 10 is basically about 10 to 130. Being trained in astrophysics and having a little experience with cosmology, we feel very good if we get things to order of magnitude. Worry about 5 or 2 or 6 or something like that. 10 to the 130 to pop. How long would it take a chemical system to try out all these possibilities? Try out the different 100-length amino acid chains. Well, let's see. We'll need to make some assumptions. I will try to make assumptions that are all favorable, very favorable, to the origin of such a thing. We will assume, first of all, that all the nitrogen in our chemical system is locked up in amino acids only. Okay, I have one per, but it may be, I'm not a biochemist, it may be that some amino acids need more than one nitrogen. So we'll not worry about that. But all the nitrogen is tied up in amino acids, okay? And let's make this huge assumption. All the amino acids are only forming 100-link chains. That certainly simplifies things. I'm going to get around the whole question of polymerization. We got them all in 100-link chains, and we got all the nitrogen on Earth or in the solar system or in a galaxy or in the universe tied up in amino acids. And we're going to make a new combination at the rate that an amino acid moves its own length at room temperature. Room temperature is way above the temperature of the universe on average. On average, it's about 100 of that. But we'll go 300 degrees Kelvin. How long does it take an amino acid to move its own length? And we'll use its own length, 10 angstroms. That may be too long. Okay, 10 angstroms, room temperature, etc. It turns out that you can form new combinations at the rate of 3 times 10 to the 11th per second. Okay, 300 billion combinations per second. Okay, why don't we first of all start with a small chemical system, all the nitrogen in the solar system. Basically all the nitrogen in the sun within a way under a percent, okay? The time to run through 110 to 130 possibilities in at the rate of 3 times 10 to the 11th per second with all the nitrogen in the solar system, 10 to the 61st year. Or, given 10 to the 11th years as approximate to AX long, 10 to the 10th years as the approximate age of the solar system, age of the universe, excuse me, there would be about one chance in 10 to the 51 that you will form, given all the nitrogen in the solar system, full set of these combinations. And therefore, you have to assume under this model, you don't really need any particular particular proteins. Just anything will work. Or at least a very big subset will work. A very small subset, there's no chance of getting through this kind of combination. Well, life is in our solar system, but we don't know that we might be the only place in the galaxy where there's life. How long will it take to form the whole galaxy? About 10 to 11 stars in the galaxy. So it works out rather easily, brings it down to 10 to the 50th years. It's still pretty big. Subtract out 10 to the 10th for the age of the universe, there's one chance of 10 to the 40th for something like that. Suppose you go to the Hubble radius, something like the known universe, the limits of the known universe. Actually, the Hubble radius would be the distance, I suppose, that things could possibly communicate with one another in the universe. And the time to form drops down to 10 to the 5 times 10 to the 37th years, achieved. 10 to the 37th years, and at 20 billion years, the chance of forming around 10 to the minus 27. There's two errors in my notes here. If you look at them, under number 2, the second line, under the assumption given 3 times 10 to the 11th combination per second, and then one chance in 10 to the 27th to form that in 20 billion years. What that means is that a person who postulates that life arose by natural processes either has to say it's an astronomically unlikely thing happened, or that there must be an awful lot of pathways in which life could function. And by an awful lot, I don't mean a large number. I mean a very large fraction, like 10 to the 28 different ways or something like that. So you really get up to where you've got some reasonable chance that in the whole Hubble universe, in the whole visible universe, or known universe, you've got something like that happening. To finish our discussion, finish up what I'm going to try and discuss here, I want to look at one other way of coming at the problem. You remember I mentioned back here earlier that a minimalistic description of what life is a self-reproducing material system. One of the early persons active in the whole question of designing computers was John von Neumann. And a problem that interested him in the last 4 or 5 years of his life was, what is the simplest machine you can design that will make copies of itself? A self-reproducing automaton. And he worked on that for several years, died before he got the stuff written up, and a friend of his, Arthur Burks, finished the work about 10 years later, found a couple errors in von Neumann's calculations. Von Neumann originally wanted to try and work into the whole question of three-dimensional problem with molecules interacting and that sort of thing. They found that was mind-boggling, so he decided to simplify the problem in a number of very substantial ways. And his approach was to say, look, let's imagine that we have an infinite array of computer chips, a two-dimensional plane of computer chips that are designed to be in any one of 29 different states. They turn themselves off and on, we imagine, power source underneath, we're not going to worry about power source. We've got these two-dimensional chips all lined up in an array, and I'm going to specify what state I put a certain number of them in, and I'm going to specify a tail of computer chips out here that store information, and I'm going to design a machine that will make a copy of itself, and in fact, it'll make a copy of any machine that you encode the right information out in this little tail of information sticking out here. And so we imagine here a two-dimensional surface, and over here, an array of these chips, which is called a universal constructor, and an information tail sticking out here that it can read the details of how to make a thing like itself, and then it builds itself a little constructing arm out here. Now, see, it doesn't build anything. It doesn't actually move any materials around. It turns the chips off and on into any one of these 29 states, and that these states then convey information out here to turn these things on into the same kind of states that this is in, and that sends out information to make a tail out here, like the tail down here, and then this machine will start to make the copy of itself out here off the picture itself. Well, von Neumann's first try at this, which needs some repairs, is to signal to lengthen this arm by one step, and two fours in succession. And so this machine turned on. The sevens come clunking down here, boom, 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 and moves this out one. And meanwhile, another copy of the seven is going off this way. So basically, this keeps rotating the same signal all the way around. Six sevens and two fours keep rotating around here rather endlessly. Meanwhile, a set of them comes wandering down here. So this, the recirculation of the signal, corresponds kind of to DNA making copies of itself or something of that sort. And the signal going out here corresponds to making a baby, making a daughter, too. Okay? Well, six sevens come down here in sequence, and they lengthen this thing by six steps. Then two fours arrive, and the two fours together make a turn left. And then the six signal, six sevens come by again, and lengthens six up here. And then two fours come by, and it turns left. And they go in again. Okay? I've designed this to work on my computer as well. I'm not a high-powered computing computer, but since they're all about this size and it would take age to run through them, I copied four different steps in the procedure from Langton's own paper, and that looks like this. You saw time 0 there. At time 35, it's gotten down here to turn left. At time 70, it's gotten up to the top to turn left again. At time 105, it's now ready to turn down again here, still turning left. And at time 120, it's about to break in down here. And at this point, when it breaks in, you have two squares. And then the break-in produces a collision signal. Signals coming that way. They generate a new type of a signal, a 6 and a 5, and 5 pulls his arm back, and the 6 goes down here and starts a new arm here, and the 5 goes propagates up the side and makes a new arm up here. So that once the daughter finishes making the baby, it turns left, if you like, and starts to make another baby, and the daughter now starts to make a baby. Somewhere here I've got another little chart I want to show you. Yeah, here it is. This chart shows the several generations run on the computer by Langton. My setup took me about, not a fast program a day, the way I designed it anyway, took me about a minute per time step and about 151 time steps to make one daughter. Okay, so that was 151 minutes. That was plenty computer time as far as I was concerned. Now, take it word for it the rest of the way. Here's the original thing with the tail on it. when it finishes making the baby, here's the baby over here with the tail pointing the same way, and the mother is now pointing up that way, and makes a new one. Here's the new one the mother's made. Here's the new one the baby's made. And now the mother turns again left and starts to make one out there. And here's the mother right here making this one. Daughter one has died at this point because the thing is set up in such a way that when the tail comes out and finds something already there, it withdraws the tail, puts a block in its information train, and that eats up all the information and winds up a dead cell with the zeros around, with ones around the inside, I guess it is, and quits, okay? So he worked this out. He ran quite a few. He's got a big computer. He's got lots of, got a big matrix to run this stuff on and all of that. But that's what he did. Well, that's a little picture to look at this thing for you. It shows that, in fact, you can design something that will make copies of itself. But something of interest to us is how complicated it is. And here's what I've tried to sketch for you here. It's certainly much simpler than von Neumann's self-reproducing automaton. I say it's nearly trivial, but it's not trivial. It's actually got the information it needs to make it in this little rotating loop of information. However, it's got an awful lot of information hidden somewhere else. That is the information that tells a cell what to do at the next time step. Notice in the picture back here, the original picture, well, we'll take this one, that obviously this tail grew and turns left, etc. There's obviously got to be some scheme by which, given a particular value for a cell at a given point, it figures out what its value is at the next point. How does it do that? Well, it does that by looking at its neighbors. Down here at the bottom of the chart, you have a cell and its four neighbors. The cell that's above it called the top cell, the cell to the right called the R cell, the cell at the bottom called the B cell, the cell to the left called the L cell, and the cell itself called the C cell, the center cell. The value of the center cell at time t plus 1 is based upon the value of the other four cells plus its own value. It's a specified conversion table, and there it is. Okay, it's not very simple. You can simplify it a little bit by having the cell be zero under all the conditions except when the answer would not be zero, allow you to write a bunch of these. But the upshot of that is this. In the cell itself, I can leave that up, I guess. In the cell itself, the body cell consists of 86 non-zero cells in one of seven states. That is 7 to the 86th power, okay? And I crank that out. It tends 4.8 times 10 to the 72nd combinations. But there's the transition rules, okay? The complexity that exists in the computer program that runs this thing, and that is 190 transition rules specifying one of the seven non-zero states. That is 7 to the 190th, or 2 times 10 to the 160th. You put the two together, you're talking about 10 to the 233 combinations. That is a lot of information, particularly when you're talking about monkeys typing Encyclopedia Britannica, far fewer combinations, and running to some astronomical numbers. Or talking about a 100-link amino acid chain. This is much larger than a 100-link amino acid chain. This is the simplest self-reproducing automaton anybody's been able to think of, and it's a very, very simple one. It's doubtful that anybody's going to come up with a simpler one that is not strictly trivial. That is, it doesn't really have information in its own chain to make copies. You're depending upon this substratum doing all the work. Because notice this one. This does not have enough information in it to make the whole copy out of this. It has enough information to make one side of the copy. But because you've chosen a square, it can reproduce the one side four times and then make four sides of the square. So it depends upon a very strong symmetry to be able to make what it's got. And you have to go to another order of magnitude to make anything more complicated than a rectangle itself. So that's really where we are at the moment on original life. Coming at it from the direction of a mathematical complexity, this is the simplest thing I've found that anybody's come up with, and it is still 10 to the 233rd combination. Set that back against the amino acids, 10 to the 130th combinations. It's 100 orders of magnitude more complicated. Okay, 100 order magnitude more complicated, but we saw there's only one chance in 10 to the 28th of even running through all the combinations of the 100-link amino acid chain. Really talking something far more complicated, but it's doing something very, very simple. It's hard to imagine a self-replicating molecule doing anything much simpler than that, and certainly not a self-replicating system doing anything simpler than that. Conclusion here is, although many people believe that there's a naturalist origin of life, there are some very huge information problems to get over, some very huge design evidences that just don't look like they're going to happen in a universe we've got. my suggestion is life looks too organized to be explained without recourse to design. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I will try to answer a few questions. I won't make any rash promises that I will succeed in answering them, but I'm certainly going to try to attempt questions. For any computer buffs out there, I'll be glad if you'd like to give you a copy in BASIC, unfortunately a rather strange kind of BASIC that works in my computer, of this particular program, if you'd like to mess with it. One thing I'm doing with this particular program is I'm trying to mutate it and see whether I can get a version that works better, etc. So far I've tried 7 mutations, and they've all killed the thing within it doesn't even make a copy of itself. It dies in about 39 steps. So we'll be interested in having somebody else do some of those experiments if I can try. Any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am. A couple different things are going on there. One, some people say, no, it really must be simpler than that, because here we are. Okay, notice that kind of begs the question. That's one suggestion that's been made. Many people say, we're here. Must have happened. But when they say, and it must have happened, grant that, but did it happen that way? That begs the question, you see. And what we seem to suggest here is, in fact, we've got a design situation. There's another alternative, and that's to say, yeah, you're right. This is astronomically unlikely. But if we're here to observe it, it must have happened. What we call the anthropic principle. It's a selection by the fact that you have to have an intelligent living thing to observe that here we are. Okay? And so the idea is, well, maybe there are trillions of universes out there, and we're the only one that's got life in it. But if we're the only one that's got life in it, naturally we'd be here to observe it. And if we're one that doesn't have life in it, well, we wouldn't be here to observe it. That really answers the question. But it does kind of try and say, well, here we are. So both of those, in a sense, smuggle in the idea, I don't like your explanation. A very strong thing that exists in science today is the assumption that bringing in the supernatural is not science. And I don't know whether I'm going to address that later here, not tonight, certainly. If you define science as the attempt to explain reality without recourse to the supernatural, why recourse to the supernatural? It's not science. It's a definition. Okay? Is that the definition of science, of the science we're really interested in doing? That, I think, is a fair question. Because there's another definition of science. Science is an attempt to explain how things really are. And, of course, if things really are designed, we're all the better finding out. And this is the very sort of places where it's likely to find it out, okay? In places where a naturalistic explanation won't explain what actually is happening. So that's kind of the way I would go. There are people who deny that it's really this unlikely, but they really haven't offered an alternative. As I say, I was really rather surprised that Dawkins in this book, I didn't even get into bibliography because I ran into it just a couple weeks ago, that Dawkins in his Blind Watchmaker is willing to grant, I will hold on to my view if we can show there's one chance in 10 to the 20 for life to arise in a billion years. My suggestion on these several calculations here is there isn't one chance in 10 to the 20 for life to arise on a given planet in a billion years. There's not even one chance in 10 to the 28th for life to arise in a whole universe in 20 billion years. So that goes up 9 orders of magnitude beyond that. And I think from this self-reproducing automaton, it clearly goes up further than that. But my suggestion is, in fact, we're not getting there. Now, I haven't seen anybody respond to Langton's discussion. If he does not discuss this whole question that we're discussing here, of how complicated this system is and what's the likelihood of producing it. He just lays out the automaton and shows that, in fact, the only thing as complicated as von Neumann. He's right about that. Okay, further comments, questions. Yeah, John.
Is there another answer? Another thing that they do is they say, well, let's start with 6 basic dimensions. Let's start with the chain of 21 and 100. That gets the odds down. Does that don't get things to do? You lose your activity,
to argue that somewhere down in the area you're talking about, you get a self-reproducing molecule, and that then natural selection will pump in all the information you need. I think there's some problems in that direction. I think John's going to address some of that question of getting any information in the natural selection of until we discuss that area. And the question of whether you can get anything that simple to reproduce is something I'm raising here with this particular model. It looks problematic to myself. Okay, yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Is it fair to suppose that since this is so long ago, we don't know enough now to speculate in a more reasonable manner as to how life can evolve? So that we can put this in two parts of the thing that we don't know, that we don't necessarily have to bring in a supernatural to give an explanation, but that we don't know enough now to make reasonable speculation.
Yeah, I would say basically that's a possibility, but at the moment it looks like that is really a cop-out because it seems although we may not know in detail what suggestions, I think they have some responsibility to try and suggest some suggestions and see whether, anything they can suggest that actually works, you can say, okay, it's at least that simple. And it might be simpler. I'm willing to grant that even with this self-reproducing automaton. Maybe you can make something simpler, but let's see. This one, I think, pretty near the ground floor, frankly. But I think you need to do the same. We don't know in detail what the conditions were on your surface, but we do know a fair bit about the physics and chemistry of things, and so we can make some attempts to work some things. What von Neumann was trying to do here, and which I think Langton succeeded in much better here, is attempting to look at the logic of the situation by getting out of some of the whole problems of moving things around in three dimensions and having to know detailed questions about chemistry and such, and see if you can get down what's the logic of the simplest thing and make copies of itself. And to me, although it looks pretty simple, when you actually sit down and crank out the numbers, you get something astronomically complicated. So I'd say this. Persons who believe in a designer have got an explanation which we know will work, okay? Here's a guy who's designed a self-reproducing automaton, which in principle can be built. I don't ever try to build it. It's very easy to model on a computer anyway. But it was designed, okay? Nobody has yet suggested a way in which one can set up a system that will design a self-reproducing thing by a process of random phenomena and then getting something reproducing and then to shape it up, if you like, beyond. So I think you have to say this. Anytime anyone comes up with a proposal, that ought to be seriously considered and such. But at the moment, one of the serious problems is that it looks like there's some very serious information complexity problems here that are not being addressed and that have driven a number of people who were not theists into the theistic camp in attempting to solve this very problem. That they have worked through this and they found this very serious problem. And they say it doesn't do any good to whistle and bark. It doesn't do any good to say we're here. We are because we are here. But that begs the question. So in a sense, you see something in our society, a very strong bias against the supernatural, but no explanation that can be demonstrated to work. If evolutionists had a computer model that would do the things that evolution is supposed to do, I think we'd have to say you really have made some kind of case, given that that there's any chance that sort of thing will arise, okay? But they don't. So I grant, one can always argue, and you can always argue this in any kind of argument, maybe new data will show up that will support our position, therefore I'm going to hold on to it, hopes it will. But a fair way to treat the data, to assume that your side will come out all right once the data has come in, although it doesn't look like it's coming out very well right now. I think you really have to say, is it possible that what we're looking at suggests that there may be a mistake in the assumption of how things get started? That's basically what I'm suggesting right here. One can adopt a wait-and-see attitude, but at the moment the situation looks very bad against that whole situation. Further comments? Yeah, and let me press on here to John Falcon.
Yeah, with the small bill, assuming that each outcome is equally likely,
weren't anyone that they would saw that they didn't need lives, but
I don't think there's any question that, say, when you're talking about molecules, the combination of one molecule with another, or combination of one atom with another, is not really probable, and that does change things, but that frequently the result is to get things worse. My understanding is Gary had done some work in that area here. He might say a word or two about that. Back in.
Equally likely would give you the maximum probability. If you have a bias, then that would drive the probability down further. Because you've got one that's very large, you still got to come every single one. That doesn't quite very small. So when you consider all your possibilities, that's going to drive your lower. To maximize the kind of things you're talking about, to maximize probability by the
Yeah, there's definitely a problem over in that direction. And the problem when you've got something like with the 20 amino acids, even if they're not likely, if all of them participate, then you're back into this situation again.